Hey, welcome to Hellbent, a feminist podcast for those who resist and persist. I'm Devin.
And I'm Sarah.
And it's still dramatic. I was listening to our episode and you were like, it's so dramatic. And I was like, yep, it is.
Yep. That's like my aesthetic for 2015. It's just to be as like big and dramatic as possible. Like just take up as much space as possible.
Hell yeah. Like be that feminist bitch you want to see in the world.
Yeah, it's funny because Roxanne Gay tweeted something earlier this week about how, you know, this year she's like, every time I want to shoot my shot, I got to do it because this fucking dickwad is breathtaking.
Yeah, absolutely. And absolutely.
It's so interesting. I feel like this like lowering, this obvious lowering of the bar for the most important job, not only in the country, but arguably the world,
absolutely,
has completely removed so many women's imposter syndrome. So like, do everything you can. Like, I'm qualified to talk about politics. I'm smart. I'm interested. I'm engaged. Like, I'm gonna do a fucking podcast.
Yeah, no, seriously. Or just other things. Like, you know, I've talked to a lot of women recently who are like, I want to run for office, but I feel like I need, like, you know, some more experience and, like, a law degree. I'm like, girl.
Nope.
You are, no.
Nope.
You do not. No, like if that makes you more comfortable, if you want to get a law degree, like live your best life, but you do not need it to run for office. That is ridiculous.
Yeah. Amanda Littman, who was Hillary Clinton's email director for the campaign, now runs an organization called Run for Something that's trying to get young people involved and elected into local statewide office, is like, you can run for city council. You can run for school board. Like, do not fucking doubt yourself.
Absolutely.
Like, you got this. So.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I'm all about that. I'm all about just, like, going for it. Because.
I know.
Fuck it. Just do
it. Fuck it.
There's just too many fucking mediocre white men who are failing upward. You are qualified.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
So, anyway, that's our little feminist pep talk.
A little feminist pep talk for this morning. Yeah. Also, really fast, I want to mention, Sarah and I are long distance again.
And by long distance, we mean LA traffic.
LA traffic distance.
We're both in the same city.
Exactly. Yeah, we really are. And she's in her room and it's dark and it like on Skype, it's like dark. And I was like, you look like on one of those crime shows where they have the witness and they obscure their face and change their voice.
I
just wanted to share that with y'all because it made me laugh really hard.
I call it my vampire room because everything is completely darked out. And I added a lamp for Devin. I was like, Devin's got to see me. And she can't really see me. It's really, in my mind, this is helpful. It's not that helpful. It's just hilarious. Now that we're done bullshitting, Devin, why don't you take us through what we're going to chat about today? We're doing something a little different again today, which I like.
We are. We got some really good feedback on the Facebook, like, big data deep dive.
Yeah.
And so we're kind of, this is a little more contexty, but I think you'll enjoy it and you'll see why. So first, we have listener feedback and general updates, as always. And then our second block is going to be about elections and voting and all the special elections and what's going on.
And like how we move forward too, because there's lots of issues that we have to work through.
Right. Absolutely. And then block three, we are interviewing Natalie Montelongo, she works for Voto Latino.
Yes.
And she works to create strategies and get people and get Latino people out to vote. So kind of a good tie in with this like election and voting theme.
Yeah.
It was also just National Voter Registration Day.
Yeah, Tuesday,
yes. And then block four is our gratitude check, as always, which we need. I need.
Always.
block five is Hellion of the Week, and we have a really good one. And then block six are action items, so something you can do after you listen to the show.
Hey Devin, so let's get into some listener feedback and some updates. So what's the first bit of feedback we've got?
So Elizabeth tweeted, quote, loved Hellbent's discussion of carrying around Hillary Clinton's book. Message is you can't tell Hillary or women to shut up. # I'm still with her.
Yeah.
That's so sweet. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we literally created a podcast. Like, you cannot get us to shut up.
Right?
I know. We talk at you for like 2 hours every week.
Oh, yeah. I was telling Sarah, I was editing our last episode, and I was like, if you have edits, save them because I cannot listen to myself talk anymore. Yeah. It's like, I can't listen to it again. I'm sorry.
I'm all talked out, all listened out. Yeah. And then Brando tweeted, please continue to call out. Hellbent, I do like the idea of calling in, but hearing you call out dickwads is incredibly therapeutic.
Yeah.
And they're referencing a listener feedback we got that was calling us in.
Right.
We kind of fucked up. And so calling in is like a different technique than calling out. It's a little bit more gentle, a little bit more personal.
Right.
I like the idea of calling in as well. I think call outs can still be useful. I think call outs are incredibly useful, especially when you're punching up,
yes.
which is what we do. Like these dickwads that are in power and are fucking around in various ways. Absolutely. We will keep calling them out.
Absolutely. But yeah, and I do think that calling out is absolutely effective. You know, I talk about this all the time. Like, we cannot soften the discourse. We need to call what is going on, what it is.
Yeah. No time to be polite.
Mm-mm. No time to be polite, but calling in is definitely useful, especially when it's obvious the other person is coming from a good, like, sort of good faith.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, this is like a whole other discussion, but, you know, I think generally people are trying to be good people, trying to be better people. And so calling in can be a great technique when you think you can get through to someone who is genuinely trying to be better. And then a correction on my end, I misquoted Teresa Kaepernick, who is Colin Kaepernick's mom. She said in regards to Trump essentially calling her son a son of a bitch, she said, that makes me a proud bitch. Obviously not a proud son of a bitch. I got too excited about her quote and I misquoted her. But like,
it's a badass quote.
Epic. Fucking epic. And that is like an example of what we were talking about last time about sort of like owning a word that is supposed to be hurtful and just being like, yeah, I'm a proud bitch.
Absolutely.
That makes me a proud bitch.
Right.
Which I love.
Yeah. And then finally, one of our listeners, Allison, emailed us. She said, quote, I just wanted to shout out both Sarah and Devin regarding Sarah's health. Coming from someone that also suffered a concussion years ago and is still dealing with the headaches and other side effects, it is so refreshing hearing Sarah being open about taking care of herself. Prioritizing health is so important, and this pod does such a great job at avoiding the, quote, push through the pain stigma that is often attached to chronic headaches. Thank you for validating the pain so many people feel every day, and it does get better, just very slowly. And Devin, thank you for being so understanding on the pod of Sarah's need to take care of herself. This podcast does such a great job of displaying community and cooperation, especially when Devin is helping Sarah with her work when she needs it. Such a great example of female friendship. Honestly, friendship in general. Thanks for being good fucking human beings to each other. I look forward to hearing you both tackle big topics with the grace and poignant commentary you always have. Y'all are amazing. Keep kicking ass and taking names.
Oh my gosh.
I know.
That's going to make me cry. That's such a beautiful email.
It is.
And it's true. Like, Devin has been absolutely phenomenal with me.
Thank you.
And Allison, I'm so sorry to hear about what you're experiencing with concussions. And please tweet at Hellbent Pod so we can
talk.
Like, we absolutely can share some notes.
Absolutely. And I do think it's so important to take care of yourself. I say a lot, like, you can't you can't take care of the world if you're not taking care of yourself. So it's so important. Self-care is so important. And, you know, paying attention to your body is so important. And yeah, I mean, I think having, and the best thing that you can have is a good support network. So we're so glad that we can provide that for each other and hopefully for our listeners. So
yeah. And I will say too, taking care of myself does not come naturally to me. Like, because I used to be an athlete, like, I have this sort of mentality in my head, like, you just push through, you grit and bear it. And it's something I still struggle with. And I will say this latest bout that has lasted more than a month was like a really big wake up call for me. It's like, bitch, you gotta take care of yourself because no one is winning here. No one's winning.
It's so true. When I did, I used to do roller derby in college, and we used to do this thing at practice. It was literally called puke and rally, where you'd skate so hard that you would puke, and then it was like a badge of honor to get back on the rink and just keep going. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I feel like there's definitely that, you know, that side of it.
Yeah, for sure.
So, okay, so some general updates. I'm going to be on International Podcast Day this Saturday, September 30th at 7 p.m. Pacific, so PST. You can watch me as well as the other speakers. It's really an incredible lineup.
Yeah,
it's really great. At internationalpodcastday.com/live. So it's live and you can chat and ask questions. So if you really want to know my real feelings about Deutsche Bank, you can ask me there. And spoiler alert, I have a lot of feelings on Deutsche Bank. So
we know this.
So yeah, and I'll be interviewing fellow Hellion Lindsay, who works in podcast advertising and sort of behind the scenes on the other side of podcasting. So we're going to be talking about being women, both in front of and behind the mic, so to speak.
I love that. I'm definitely going to be watching. And like I said on Monday, hardcore trolling you.
Hardcore trolling. Yeah, I look forward to it.
Asking all the wrong questions at all the wrong times.
That's amazing. And then, yeah, our newsletter goes out next Tuesday. So sign up at hellbentpodcast.com/newsletter and to get the newsletter. It's called Raising Hell and it's really good.
It's fun. We're a little biased, but it's real fun.
Okay, Sarah, so let's get into our big news block for today. So we're going to talk about special elections, but first, some other bullshit.
Yeah, we want to top line some Trump bullshit because that's always sort of in the background,
right,
front and center, if you will. So a couple of things that are swirling around that we'll probably get to on Monday's podcast. So Trump and the Republican Party have introduced their tax plan. So they couldn't get healthcare done. So they're like, on to the next, like, let's try to do this tax plan.
Right.
And it's exactly what you would think a rich motherfucker would make out of a tax plan. I think the New York Times framed it in their tweet, like, it helps the wealthy and like does not help the poor. Like, that's all you really need to know. They're really trying to sell it as like helpful to the middle class, but don't believe their bullshit. And Devin is all about that tax reform life. Like, she wants to really like get into it, so we'll probably get into it more deeply on Monday.
For this episode, I was like, oh, you know, we could do a deep dive into tax reform and like the tax code, and Sarah was like, no.
I legit vetoed it, and I actually kind of regret it because I'm like, no, this is actually, it would be really good. So I think we're gonna do it on Monday once we learn even more, I think.
Right. And then, so the Trump administration is also abruptly pulling out of Obamacare outreach events in states. So, Leda, we knew that they were cutting the budget and like canceling ads and outreach and getting people signed up for Obamacare. But now they're just straight up like not doing it at all. Like, they're like, nope, fuck it.
This was a big scoop from Vox, and then BuzzFeed added to the reporting as well. So like, they're pretty much doing everything they can to sabotage Obamacare. Like, I think I saw a tweet from someone who was like, this is not how someone would act if they were trying to get people to sign up for healthcare. Like, this is so fucking irresponsible, which apparently is par for the course in this fucking presidency, but definitely something to keep an eye out on because they weren't able to repeal Obamacare, but they are trying to ruin it, I guess, in other ways.
Well, that was always Trump's strategy, was like, okay, well, we don't have to repeal it. We'll just let it implode and then deal with it, which is a direct quote. So fuck that.
And then the Russia investigation is heating up. More drip, 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 drip. Facebook is now joined in the hot seat by Twitter, which experts say was just as instrumental in interfering in the 2016 election as Facebook. And I saw a story that Twitter might have been even more instrumental.
Yeah.
Like, there were even more bots on Twitter. And if you ask any woman on Twitter in 2015 and 2016, she would have been like, lay fucking duh.
Right.
I mean, the deluge of harassment that I received on Twitter and that other women received is like, we've been telling y'all, you literally could have just asked women. And like, we would have been like, lay duh.
Right. And now that experts are like, you know, there's some like fucky harassment on Twitter, and every woman is like, oh, really?
Yeah. Now that a man has said it, like, people believe us. And also, it's interesting because Mark Zuckerberg has also walked back. He's essentially apologized for comments he made earlier about how, like, there's no way that, you know, it's crazy that this is his quote, like, it's crazy that Facebook, like, affected the election in any way, essentially.
Right.
And he said, okay, yeah, that was a pretty, like, ridiculous thing for me to say.
Yeah,
which is
obviously.
Super interesting. And I think we're going to see public testimony, hopefully, from reps from Facebook and Twitter soon. So that'll be super interesting.
Juicy. I'm excited.
Yes, me too.
It's the little things these days.
It's the little things like Russian interference, like, in our fucking election. What is this? What is life?
I don't know.
This is like ridiculous. This is how ridiculous this presidency is. We're like, oh yeah, like little Russian interference, you know, light interference.
Light treason.
Yeah.
Light treason, committed some
exactly.
Light treason.
We literally ummed at the same time. That was really cute. Let's get into our special election coverage. So what's the first story we want to talk about, Devin?
Yeah, so, you know, 2018 or 2018 is coming up fast, but we do have all these special elections that are filling vacated seats or, you know, other sort of off-season, as it were,
elections.
Mm-hmm. Off-cycle, yeah. So on Tuesday, two Democratic women took long-held Republican state legislature seats. And so thus far in 2017, Democrats have flipped 8 GOP states. And according to the
GOP
Daily...
Seats,
not states. Seats, sorry.
No worries.
According to Daily Coast, the 8 flipped districts went to Trump by an average of 13 points in the 2016 election.
Wow.
So that's a huge swing.
Yes.
And the number of seats flipped from Democrat to Republican is goose egg. And Sarah was like, what the hell is goose egg? I was like, it's zero. Like, it looks like a goose egg. And she was like, who are you?
It's really funny because I'm at a point. I'm in this like sort of popular slang purgatory of life where I don't know if I'm too old to know if something is like current.
Right.
Or not old enough to realize that it's like old timey phrase.
Right.
So I'm like,
right.
Which one is it? I literally don't know. I was like, Devin, I have no idea what this means.
Like, I'm trying to be funny here, Sarah.
I like it.
Come on.
Like it. I'm just like dense. I don't know. But it's true. Republicans have not flipped any democratically held seats, but
right.
Democrats so far, it looks like, have flipped 8 seats and, you know, sort of at the state and local level. So the first woman we wanted to talk about, the first Democratic woman who won one of these elections that flipped seats was Annette Tadeo. And she won a Florida state Senate seat in a district that went for Hillary in 2016, but usually goes for Republicans down ballot. And I think a lot of people were surprised by her win.
Yes.
They didn't think that she could pull it off, but she fucking did.
Yes. She's also, this is her third time as a candidate.
Oh,
so she's lost twice and she was like, fuck it, I'm just going to keep doing it. And then she won.
Keep on keeping on.
I know.
Yeah.
And so on Tadeo's win, she said, quote, the results show that anger with Trump and grassroots activism can and will continue to help Democrats win seats. Though she has run for office a number of times in Florida, she said this is the first time she's seen so much grassroots energy.
Yeah.
So I think that's key. I mean, I think that people are really involved and they woke up and they were like, hi.
Yep.
I need to deal with this.
Uh-huh. Yep.
So I think that's definitely part of it.
I think all these state level and local level wins like really highlight that. And that's what encourages me.
Right.
Amidst this monstrosity is I think that the energy is there.
Right.
And it's really heartening to see Democrats wake the fuck up and flip seats.
Yeah.
In these sort of like less quote unquote less sexy elections, but they are really crucial.
Oh, yeah. And then the other woman we're going to talk about is Carrie Lerner, which no relation to Sarah Lerner.
I don't think so. I mean, we might be family. I might,
right?
You know, I got to like retweet her and be like, yo, are we related?
Are we related?
Because you're a badass.
Yeah, right. She won a New Hampshire seat in a district that went for Trump by 23 points in 2016. So that is just a huge, huge number.
And you know what? We are seeing shit like that.
Like, I know.
Huge swings.
Absolutely. And so, you know, on Lerner's win, she said, quote, Lerner said that she attributes her win to a combination of local issues and her district's growing frustration with the fact that politicians, especially those in Washington, won't listen to their concerns. Many of the people who told Lerner they voted for her, she said, voted for Trump in November, but have grown to regret that decision.
That is super interesting.
Yeah.
Because we hear a lot about how Trump is like Teflon Don and like his base will never leave him. And that is probably true. Like there's probably like a core support of like people that know literally what he said, he could shoot someone in Fifth Avenue Avenue and get away with it. And no one would like fucking like blink an eye.
Yeah.
There are people like that. But I think there are also people who are starting to leave and starting to, like she said, regret their decision. And I don't think those are people that Democrats should center in their outreach efforts, but it shows that they are gettable.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that basically Trump has this whole narrative that like what he's like, that he basically has like a mandate, like he won. And so everyone wants him to do all of these things. But I think that's just not true. You know, we know that like Graham Cassidy had what, like a 20% approval rating or something ridiculous like that.
Yeah.
And so I think that these sort of state and local elections reveal that people aren't happy and that these, you know, it makes it clear that people are really not comfortable with what's going on and are like, hey, wait, we need to do something different.
And I think it also shows that Democrats shouldn't be shy about running against Trump, right? Everyone's always talking about, oh, we need a positive message. Sure. But I don't think that means that we cannot go negative on Trump, because there's lots of negative things that you can run on what's going on with him and congressional Republicans.
Right. And it's a good thing to point out. I mean, that's, you know, people are upset and, and you know, saying I'm going to be something different is important.
Yeah.
And I think it's also important to note that while some of the big special election races were not taken by Democrats, so like John Ossoff in Georgia 6 and Rob Quist in Montana, those margins were thin, you know, so these were reliably red seats, and the GOP sweated bullets and pulled off wins by virtually nothing. So shit is moving.
And
even not winning, but just sort of moving the needle that much. John Ossoff ran for Newt Gingrich's seat, for Christ's sake.
Yeah.
I mean, like, and the fact that he got so far says a lot.
Yeah. And I think the trend lines, you know, a lot can happen between now and November 2018, but the trend lines point positively toward Democrats. And I think you're right. That's something to keep in mind, and it matters. And like you said, those were reliably red seats. That's a big part of why Trump appointed, you know, people like Ryan Zinke and Tom Price to his administration, because he felt Republicans felt like they could easily retake those seats. And we proved that they cannot.
Right.
It's not going to
be
fucking easy.
Okay.
So since we're talking about special elections, so we had this like great positive story about Democrats flipping seats. Awesome. Let's talk about what's motherfucking happening in Alabama.
Oh, Alabama is a hot fucking mess right now for the Republican Party. So, you know, so remember when I kind of said that state and local elections can reveal what's really going on in people's minds?
Yeah.
Roy Moore is actually a really good example of this, sort of in the other direction.
Yeah.
So Roy Moore won the GOP primary to fill Jeff Sessions's vacated seat so he could become attorney general. The current and appointed incumbent, Luther Strange, was endorsed personally by Trump and is considered a fairly traditional Republican. And he lost that primary, and the GOP is kind of freaking the hell out.
You know what's like, really wild about that, too, is Trump started deleting all of his tweets in support of Luther Strange. Right. And people were like, did you think we would forget? Like,
That's such classic gaslighting.
Yeah, I mean, like
I never said that.
This is not how any of this works yet, because apparently he was like really embarrassed because he doesn't like quote unquote losers. Right. So he like doesn't want to associate himself with them. And like we talked about on Monday's podcast, Roy Moore is a more Trumpian candidate, but Mitch McConnell was basically like, Trump like fucking endorsed this Luther Strange guy.
Right.
And it's really odd for sitting presidents to endorse in primaries.
Yes.
Because one would imagine they have more shit to do. And like,
they
obviously, it's probably preferable to wait to just endorse the winner.
Right. Right.
But okay, so let's talk about this dickwad Roy Moore. Who the fuck is he, Devin?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked. So he's a, quote, religious activist, which just means that he is a complete dickwad who thinks that Christianity is the only religion that should be allowed in this country. He's also a former judge that defied a court order to remove like a plaque of the Ten Commandments that he had in his courtroom. So instead of doing that, when he became Chief Justice of Alabama, he put a 5,000-pound granite statue of the Ten Commandments in the building. And then he was actually removed as a judge in 2003 because of this. They were like, no, we told you to get rid of it. You doubled down, get rid of it, or we're going to remove you as a judge.
He got removed as Chief Justice, though, right? Yeah. Like, it wasn't mm-hmm. just him as a judge. It was like he was right. elected as Chief Justice of yeah. the Alabama Supreme Court. And then he was removed, or he was yeah. sort of forced to resign after he'd gotten elected again years later.
Yeah.
Which just
yeah.
says a lot that he would get reelected and then had to be removed again.
Right. I mean, it's kind of ridiculous.
Yeah.
He also wants to ban homosexuality, which I'm like, okay, I don't even know how you'd go about that, like, just logistically, but well, okay.
And that was, I believe, part of why he got removed the second time, because he yeah. was trying to defy current law.
Right.
And people were like, you can't motherfucking do that. Like,
right.
Like, you're the Chief Justice. You're supposed right. to respect the law, and you're not.
Yes. He also pulled a gun out on stage at a campaign rally.
Yep.
And I'm not making this up. He was literally at a campaign rally. He pulled out a gun out of his vest, pointed it at the ceiling, and said, I believe in the Second Amendment. So I'm pretty sure that is definitely what the framers intended for the Second Amendment. What do you think?
For sure. There were like,
for sure.
some Republican dickwad in Alabama is going to need to pull it out at right. some point to make a show.
Right.
And that's why we put the Second Amendment in place for that guy.
For that
he
guy.
He also, exactly. strangely enough, I heard, was asked about DACA on a radio interview.
Okay.
Literally had no idea what it was.
Oh, of course. Why would he know? Like, mm-hmm. that makes perfect sense. He's just running for, like, a House seat, whatever.
A Senate seat.
Fuck.
Yeah,
not even Senate, a House seat.
Yep, nope. It's Senate seat.
Yeah. Why would he need to know what DACA is? It's not like he's trying to, like, make policy or anything.
Again, women who don't think you're qualified for anything, you are fucking qualified and you are needed. If you are progressive
Seriously.
And or a woman, you are fucking needed.
Yeah, like, get in there.
And that's really just the tip of the iceberg. And I really want to talk about Devin before we go on to other complexities of this story. I want to
yep.
talk about a word that has been attached to him in a lot of news
yes.
stories that I've seen. He has been called a quote-unquote firebrand a lot.
Right.
Can we talk about how firebrand is a hell of a euphemism for racist motherfucker?
Yes. I mean, I think, again, this is the sort of softening of the discourse.
Right.
So instead of calling this guy a fucking racist dickwad,
right.
people are like, oh, he's a firebrand. He's just feisty. Like,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
This is not some, like, quirky personality, like, characteristic. Like, this is a deep, deep flaw in this guy, in this person's, like,
well, it's a deep flaw. I think it's a deep flaw also in a mostly white media that does not
right.
know how to accurately describe extremist things
right.
and extremist racists. And I think, you know, Chris Hayes put it really well. He said, you know, to call someone like Roy Moore a firebrand or controversial really doesn't communicate how extreme he is. Like,
right.
a better descriptor is a lawless theocrat.
Right.
Which, again, is sort of indicative of the reasons why he was removed as Chief Justice twice.
Right.
And this is also on the heels of the Columbia Journalism Review sort of advising journalists that they should be labeling Trump's rhetoric as racist.
Yes.
They're saying
yes.
you are not accurately describing what Trump is doing if you are sort of dancing around this issue and not calling him racist. And I think this comes up with Roy Moore, too. So I
right.
think, like, a mostly white media really doesn't know how to handle these issues well. And we're
right.
seeing that in extremist candidates who just go mainstream, partly because, like you said, we're softening the discourse and we really
right.
can't do that.
Right, right. Well, and them, you know, these sort of like extremists becoming mainstream, which was sort of the whole idea that Trump ran on.
Right.
Like I said, is the GOP is freaking the hell out.
Right.
So, you know, the New York Times reported, quote, Republicans are confronting an in- an insurrection on the right that is angry enough to imperil their grip on Congress. And senior party strategists have concluded that the conservative base now loathes its leaders in Washington the same way it detested President Barack Obama.
Yeah. And this kind of reminds me of what Sarah Kendzior had to say, like almost or close to a year ago. She said, she said to Republican leaders, your loyalty to Trump will not be rewarded.
Right, right.
And I think we're seeing this really clearly here.
Yeah, I mean, from what I understand, the Times just reported that the GOP strategists are literally like, Trumpian populists have jumped the fucking shark, y'all.
Yeah, and like, populist is another, I think, euphemism as
it
well.
It is. Right? It is. Like, I mean, I don't love the term populist. Like I said, it's slippery and it doesn't really mean anything. But I think the Republican leadership and strategists are like, we pushed this whole populist idea and now it's coming to bite us in the butt cheeks.
Well, and also to this like sort of religious extremism and like appeal to evangelicals was starting to happen before Trump. Like Bush really harnessed them. And that's sort of like part of why he was able to win. And I think we're seeing that being taken to such extremes with Trump and with some of these candidates like Roy Moore who are appearing on the scene. And it's really interesting because Moore's opponent is Doug Jones. So the Democrat running against Moore is Doug Jones, who's a former federal prosecutor. He's also someone that took on the KKK in Alabama and won, which was like a pretty ballsy thing to do. And I think that Jones feels like he has a better chance of winning against someone like Moore than Luther Strange.
Yes.
Although when I posted in the group about it, I was like, in our Facebook group, I was like, are there any Alabama hellions in here? And we had one hellion who said she's from Alabama, doesn't live there anymore. But she said she thinks a lot of Republicans are still going to hold their noses and vote for Moore because they hate Democrats so much.
So much. Yeah. I mean, I think Jones said in an interview that he would seek support from Republican and independent voters who might not be able to hold their nose and vote for Moore. And so we'll see if that plays out in a longer strategy. But I also think this might create one of those like thinner margins where this should be a reliably red state. This should be pretty easy. This is Jeff Sessions' seat, for Christ's sake. Mm-hmm. And the GOP is sort of like, well, we're a little fucked here.
Well, but it's also very telling too, I think, that conggressional Republicans have already thrown their vocal support behind Moore because Republicans always fall in fucking line. I think there's a tribalism that exists on the Republican side that doesn't so much exist on the Democratic side. Yeah, this is what happens, I think, with Republicans a lot. And Joy Reid talks about this sort of tribalism. And it's sort of echoed in what our Hellion said. It's like she thinks a lot of people who are Republicans are just going to hold their nose and vote for Moore.
Right, and just because there's an R next to his name and not a D.
Yeah, and he could very well be the next senator in Alabama, which is really, really, really creepy.
Yeah, it is really creepy. It's tough to say. I mean, people, I think, are also just straight up pissed with what's going on in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a memo circulated among Republican donors that basically was saying that primary voters are intensely angry and inclined to blame Republicans for the dysfunction in Washington.
Right.
So, which is kind of why this like Roy Moore, anti-candidate. I don't really know what to call him.
Anti-establishment.
Okay. Anti-establishment, which, I hate that term.
Too. Yeah.
But who kind of like snuck in. And I think that has something to do with it. People are angry. So
I think too, I think this discussion on elections wouldn't be complete without talk about voter suppression.
Yes.
Because we're talking about how, so there's like these really, really disturbing signs of like the kind of candidates that Republicans are putting up congressional seats and how, the trend lines look good for Democrats. But voter suppression is a huge fucking issue, not only morally, but electorally for Democrats.
Right. So their Mother Jones cites a new study about Wisconsin in the 2016 election. And they sort of looked at how voter suppression worked in Wisconsin because they had a strict voter ID law that was implemented for the 2016 election. So,
and remember, too, that the 2016 election was the first presidential election without the full protections of the Voting Rights Act.
Right.
Because the Supreme Court, in a 5-4 decision in 2013, gutted it.
Right. So, okay. So let's just remember also that Trump won Wisconsin by just over 22,000 votes.
Right.
So every vote here was crucial.
Right.
So the study found, quote, researchers at the University of Wisconsin-Madison surveyed registered voters who didn't cast a 2016 ballot in the state's two biggest counties, Milwaukee and Dane, which is home to Madison. More than 1 out of 10 non-voters, 11.2%, said they lacked acceptable voter ID and cited the law as a reason why they didn't vote. And 6.4 of respondents said that the voter ID law was the main reason they didn't vote.
And these counties are strong Democratic.
Right.
Counties. And, right. You know, the study's lead author, who's a political scientist at the University of Wisconsin, his name is Kenneth Mayer, said that roughly between 9,000 and 23,000 registered voters in these counties were deterred from voting by the ID law. And sort of extrapolating from this data, he estimated that 45,000 voters statewide sat out the election because of these kind of reasons.
Right.
Although he said it's difficult to sort of estimate this,
from just two counties. I mean, it's relatively small.
But I think voter suppression is an issue that hasn't been talked about enough in these election postmortems, and they're very concerning for future elections. Again, not only because it's morally fucking repugnant to stop people from exercising their right to vote, and it does tend to be people of color who do tend to be Democratic voters. And
right.
It is by design. Republicans are doing this by fucking design.
Well, yeah. I mean, let's say it was, about 22,000 registered voters in, quote, reliably Democratic counties that were deterred from voting. I mean, is it just me or is that the fucking margin that Trump won by?
Right. And, you know, it's interesting. There was a column in the New York Times this week called that talked about the rule of the tyranny rule of the minority.
Right.
And how our electoral systems are sort of set up. And now we've come to this point where, you know, the Constitution is supposed to have all these checks and balances to prevent the tyranny rule of the majority. But
right,
what's happening
right.
now is the minority is ruling over all of us. I mean, 3 million
right.
more people voted for Hillary Clinton, and we're seeing these voter ID laws that probably had a big effect on these razor thin margins in key battleground states that ended up going for Trump.
Right.
And we're in the situation where we are being ruled by a president and a Congress that
right.
most of us don't want.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, and, you know, you alluded to it earlier, Sarah, but this study also found, of course, that they found socioeconomic and racial disparities among those impacted by this new law.
Yeah.
The burdens of voter ID fell disproportionately on low income and minority populations. More than 20% of registrants coming from homes with incomes less than $25,000 say they were kept from voting by the law. 8.3% of white voters surveyed were deterred, compared with 27.5% of African Americans.
Yep. There is a definite racial component. And like you said, a socioeconomic component, which play into each other.
Right. So please read this whole article, because I'm tempted to just copy and paste the whole thing on our outline and then just fucking read it to you, because it was so illuminating.
Well, and this is work from Ari Berman.
Yes.
And he's great. He is a great follow on voting rights, voter suppression. And, you know, this is also in the backdrop of, you know, Trump's sort of scam commission on voter integrity, quote unquote, or whatever.
Right.
Where really they're trying to limit the rights of
right.
people from voting. And so this is something that I think we all need to take very seriously, and we all need to have on the top of our mind, especially as we're approaching 2018.
We are so excited to have Natalie Montelongo with us. She is the National Organizing Director for Voto Latino, where she is responsible for developing and implementing the organization's field plan and voter engagement strategy. Prior to joining Voto Latino, Natalie served as the political director for the Hillary for Colorado campaign in the general election and was part of the Hillary for Nevada team in the primary. Each of these states proved to be bright spots in mobilizing the Latino vote to help ensure victory. While on the campaign, Natalie created and implemented national programs that increased civic participation and provided educational opportunities to Latino communities. In Nevada, she founded Mujeres in Politics, a bilingual program geared towards increasing voter participation amongst Hispanic women. While in Colorado, she co-wrote Mi Sueño Tu Voto, My Dream Your Vote, a national voter registration program that created a seat at the table for undocumented youth and empowered them to organize coalitions of immigrants eligible to vote. Prior to the campaign, Natalie served as a presidential appointee at the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative. Welcome, Natalie, and wow. Everything you did in 16 is amazing. What I did in 2016 was feed myself, so.
Well, I think it was a special year, having been Hillary's fan for a very long time, and also, obviously, the opportunity to help elect the first woman president in my lifetime. I thought this can come again, but maybe not in my lifetime. Right. And if I could make a difference and help, then I will devote my entire life to do that. So I literally just said goodbye to DC and went off to Vegas and started organizing there.
That's amazing. I always say that I wasn't really politically engaged before this, and that's my greatest regret, biggest mistake, is that I didn't get more involved.
There's a lot to do now, and you're leading the charge in the best way, and I think it's really important to be digital right now, because everyone is.
Right.
So, yeah.
Yeah, it's really great. So can you tell us more about the organization you work for, Voto Latino?
Yeah, absolutely. So obviously post-campaign, I thought the most important thing for me to do was to focus on the Latino vote. And I thought I felt the sense of urgency. And so I decided to dive right in and work for an organization that's specifically looking to mobilize and engage Latino millennial voters. And so Voto Latino has been around for 13 years. It was co-founded by Rosario Dawson and our CEO, Maria Teresa Kumar, because they recognized that there was no Latino representation and during presidential campaigns or even to engage voters. And they thought, why don't we just run a PSA with someone who looks like us to see what the outcome is? And they found that, in fact, it engaged a lot of new voters because they saw and recognized themselves in the PSA. And so that tiny seed developed into what is now an organization that's been leading the front in Latino millennial engagement, but digital first.
Right.
So we were the first ones to, for example, partner up with MySpace to do voter registration when MySpace first launched. And we were the first to partner with iTunes to deliver music and partner with artists to kind of engage this subsect of the population. Because we know that that's where our audience lives more than ever. And I feel like Latinos specifically, I know millennials obviously are very digital, but Latinos specifically, 90% of our Latino millennials access internet via their mobile phones.
Right.
And so it's important for us to live and exist where they work, play, communicate with their friends. So we've been at the forefront of all of that digital stuff. We created an app called VoterPal, which allows you to register yourself and your friends by taking a photo. It scans. It's really neat. It scans the back of your ID, auto-populates all of the information, so it makes it really quick.
That's awesome.
And it's peer-to-peer.
Yeah.
And I think that's why what we do works. We come up and develop all of these things and tools that are peer-to-peer, that live where our audience lives.
Right.
They're easy to access and they're fast. I think that's the most important thing. We're always in a hurry.
Right.
But now they brought me on because post-election, obviously, there was a lot of fear within our community. And there had been attacks made to our community during the campaign. And so during the campaign, I know that my predecessor did an amazing job into cultivating these 12 college campus chapters. And so we started organizing that way. And then post-election, when I came on, it was just a boom of outreach from people And while before we thought, okay, digital is the way to do it, we've now realized we need digital, but we need to be on the ground because we recognize that there's a need for community.
Right.
And I feel like people trust our brand. They trust what we say. And so they wanted to create chapters. And so now I'm working with, we've now are up to 25 chapters. And
wow.
It's not just campuses. It's, yeah, and it's been in a span of 7 months.
Wow.
So you see the need. It's real and it's really genuine.
Yeah.
And so now it's city chapters, college campus chapters, and we just established our very first official high school chapter in Las Vegas.
Oh, that's awesome.
And it's really, really incredible. I just went to see them for the first time last week. I spent some time with them. We talked about what their goals would be, and they're just really, really excited. And I've honestly never seen this type of engagement.
Yeah.
And I feel like it's also empowering because young people are now recognizing the power of their strength. You know, they're not no longer waiting for someone to come knock on their door and tell them what to do.
Right.
I feel like they feel empowered to be the leaders in their community, to take charge, to step up and organize. And so we're trying as hard as we can to keep up with the demand and organize them and give them trainings and give them the tools that they need so that they can succeed within their community.
Yeah, that's amazing. And especially, you know, at the high school level, like early engagement is so important. And, you know, especially as these states are starting to allow like pre-voter registration, so you can register when you're 16 or 17 and then it automatically populates when you're 18. I think that's amazing. And I love the idea of community as well and creating not just a digital community, but a kind of boots on the ground, so to speak, which is really great.
It's honestly, actually, you hit the nail on the head. It's the earlier you can start engaging with them, the better. And so the states that actually allows earlier voter registration, you'll see that there's higher civic participation amongst younger people.
Right.
And I think that's something that actually we've been trying to work into what we do here, to try for the states that do allow early, voter registration to make it almost part of, you know, their steps into adulthood.
Right.
And I know that when I was younger, I remember, you know, getting my driver's permits and I knew that that was going to happen when I was 15.
Right.
And I knew that registering at 18, could actually vote at 18. That was another step. And then obviously 21
right.
and then going to college and all of that. And I think that we've been really, really trying to add into the narrative of when states allow people to register at 16 years old, that is a step in the narrative
right.
of their trajectory into adulthood. And if not, then absolutely 18 years old, you register to vote, and that voting is actually part of the trajectory as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So I wanted to ask you a little bit about Trump's stance on DACA, which has been in the news a lot recently, and he's, you know, kind of said a lot about it. So has that stance on DACA impacted Latino voting or Latino political participation in general recently?
Yeah, you know, I think it's impacted... It really has. And we've seen here at VL, we're really hyper-focused on making sure that people are heard, that their stories are heard. And I think we are so in awe by how fierce and how fearless Dreamers have been in coming out and telling their stories, even though their lives are at stake. It's 800,000 young people whose lives are at risk right now. And so I think something that's really interesting, and you can see the power of storytelling, right?
Right.
How that transcends into action.
Right.
And so we see that these Dreamers are out in press conferences, and we've also seen cases where right after a press conference, a person will be detained.
Right.
And even after that, people will continue to tell their story because this really affects, it's going to affect their lives. But I think that... as millennials, we see them, we care about what's happening to our peers.
Right.
They're our peers, you know, as millennials. Aside from them being immigrants and being here on DACA, they're our peers. They're from our generation. And I think that becomes something way more personal to us. And so I've seen an amount of coalition building that I've never seen before. And I've also seen a lot of intersection coalition building. And so I've seen organizations from outside of the Latino, your normal Latino organizations step up and ask, hey, how can we help? How can we use our voices to leverage? And that's why I feel like you've seen Forward, for example, has been a really great ally to this process and to bringing in business, big businesses, and to being outspoken to this. So you've seen Facebook come out and talk about the importance of protecting our dreamers.
Right.
In general, I feel like the American public, 80% of it, believes that we should protect our dreamers. And so it's really driven people out to protect them. We had a call a couple of days ago, actually, to see what we can do here in DC, but also on the ground, and how we can leverage our own resources on the ground to protect them and be outspoken. And I think there are about 40 organizations on the line.
Wow.
And so it's a really coordinated effort. We want to make sure that our messages are clear. We want to make sure that we're driving the same message across, that we're aligned on everything we do. And to be honest, I haven't seen this type of coordinated engagement in a while.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that makes perfect sense. You know, people come together, like you said, people come together when it's our peers, we're personally invested, storytelling, that's so important. So I feel like there seems to be this myth that Latinos don't vote. And is this true in your experience?
No. It is a myth. And I think it was also a myth coming out of the 2016 election, because exit polls seem to be telling us something different.
Right.
But in fact, I feel the truth is we actually expanded the electorate almost by 2 million more voters
Wow.
than in 2012.
Wow.
And while we didn't get the results that we wanted to in the election, I think that there were really great bright spots. Colorado, for example, we expanded the electorate in Colorado. We sent the first Latina state Speaker of the House. Her name is Crisanta Duran. And so that was a really great, big, bright spot. In Nevada, we also expanded the electorate. We flipped the state house and the state senate,
yeah.
So they're now all blue. And actually, the state senate is only won, I think, by one seat. So a lot of really hard work.
Right,
And we sent Catherine Cortez Masto,
right.
Our first Latina senator ever. And I think that we shouldn't take that for granted. And people overshadow that a lot by Trump's win, but I think that these are really positive gains for us and for the progressive community. And I think that a lot of that was because there was real investment into the Latino community. I know that in the states like Colorado and Nevada, not only had the campaign been there early investing in the community, I think we were there 8 months before the primary.
Wow.
Just organizing, expanding our voter rolls. But besides that, President Obama had been organizing there since 2008. So there was consistent presence there, and there was an infrastructure built. And besides the campaign side of it, I feel like these states also have really, really great progressive organizations who coordinate amongst themselves on the ground.
Yeah.
In Nevada, for example, even if they're not Latino-led, even if they're not Latino-focused organizations, they are Latino-led.
Right.
And so there also I feel like, has a lot to do with your cultural competency. Who is leading these organizations from an organization level, but also from the campaign sides? In both Nevada and in Colorado, the state directors were both Latinos.
Right.
And had started campaigns or their campaign careers as organizers. So they understood the field really well, but they were also really culturally competent in the way that they built their own teams and the way that they built their own programs. So all of that has to do with voter turnout. And I feel like something that we don't talk about enough is how much are we actually investing in the community?
Yeah.
There are a couple of, I know I'm jumping ahead into a lot of different sections, but there are states like Texas where there's a huge Latino population booming there, but the infrastructure is not there.
Right.
And we haven't invested in it as much as we can. And that's why Texas, time and time again, has been one of the lowest performing, not only in terms of voter registration, but voter turnout
right.
in the nation. I think in recent years, it was 45th.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's awful. And then, also, how do voter suppression tactics keep Latinos from voting? Especially, we hear it a lot in Texas, for example. And are there any like new bills or laws that are coming up that are aimed at suppressing the Latino vote?
Yeah. So actually, Texas is a perfect example of this. They make it really difficult. And just to back up, for millennials in general, it's I feel like what's really difficult about voting for millennials is that we move around a lot.
Yeah.
Me, for example, in the last 2 years, I lived in Virginia and then I went to Vegas and then I moved to Chicago and then I was living in Denver
right.
and now I'm back in D.C. And so I unfortunately didn't get a new ID in every state when I moved. And I think that's something that it doesn't happen just to me.
Right.
It happens to all millennials. And states like Texas, for example, don't allow you to vote with student IDs.
Yeah.
It has to be either a state ID or a federal form of ID, which is a passport that not everyone has. And so that's an obstacle for millennials in general. But in Texas specifically, they make it extremely hard for you to register people to vote. So you have to be deputized per county.
Wow.
And yeah. And so if, for example, you want to register people to vote outside of a Spurs game, they have to be, unfortunately, from your county for them to register your vote. Otherwise, you have to be deputized for whatever other county they may be from.
Wow. Oh, I had no idea.
Oh, there's also no online voter registration. There's a lot of laws that really prohibit you from registering to vote. And not only that, it prohibits others to come in and help
right.
you. For example, in Nevada, when we have Get Out the Vote, we're able to call in our friends and family to come in from out of town, and we're able to train them on voter registration, give them a clipboard, send them out on their way, and then they can stand outside of a grocery store or wherever it may be to register people to vote. You're not allowed to do that in Texas because you have to be an actual resident of Texas to even be deputized to register people to vote in that county.
Wow. Oh, my gosh. I had no idea.
Yeah.
It's so mind-blowing, and especially because in California, we don't necessarily have a lot of these restrictions. Like, after I got married, it took me forever to change my last name on my voter registration. Forever. And they didn't care. They're like, yeah, it's fine. We get it. Yeah. No problem. And so the fact that there's such, like, a split between just state by state, or that some states require you to be deputized to register people to vote, is just really, I had no idea.
Yep. And I feel like by now, to be honest, all states should also have online voter registration.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Like you said, that's where the audience lives.
Yeah. And it's not because they don't have the tools, or there's other states who have already done it and can easily share the process.
Sure.
Colorado has a really, really great system. Colorado is great because of many reasons. They have mail-in ballots. So you get your ballots mailed, and because of that, you have higher turnout higher early voting rates. And on top of that, you're able to register at the luxury of your home or your phone through the Secretary of State's website.
Right.
And so for a state to not have online voter registration in 2017 is because they're just obstructing you from doing so, not because they're incapable of doing
it. Right. The technology is definitely there, and it's not even it's not even obscure. Like, it's great.
No.
And so can you talk a little bit about what your group is doing to sort of get people out, Latinos out to vote? It can be hard to get people to vote during big, like, federal and presidential elections, and almost impossible to get them to vote in these smaller special elections. So is your group doing anything to sort of, get people out?
Yeah, absolutely. I think something that we've recognized is that you need to have consistent presence in the community, whether it's a presidential race or not. You have to be there. And that's why I feel like issue advocacy is so important, because while there might not be a next major race, you can have consistent presence by informing people and individuals on the issues that are happening. That's why letting people know of DACA is so important, because this is another way of mobilizing people. If you inform people of what's happening and what's at stake, and how their vote actually reflects all of these consequences that we're living now, then they'll connect the dots. Unfortunately, some communities don't have the luxury of knowing that.
Right.
And it takes an extra step for you to be there every day, give them the news that they need in a way that's accessible to them, and just be present. And so that's why I think it's really important for us to continue building chapters, to continue informing them and teaching them how to inform others in their community, basically creating a domino effect.
Right.
And really, above all, it's really, really important to create tools that are peer-to-peer that you can just download and empower yourself to empower others and make it as simple as possible.
Right, right. That makes perfect sense. Wow, yeah. Kind of on that note, at the end of each interview, we like to ask for a gratitude check. It can be big or small, personal or political, just something to take stock of the good things that are happening in these rather dark political times, like you mentioned. So what are you grateful for today?
I'm honestly just really grateful that people are showing up for immigrants.
Yeah.
I think something, while there is a huge fight on DACA, I think it's also important to recognize that some immigrants are also American citizens.
Yeah.
And to give us that respect, I feel, because surely we haven't gotten it from the administration. But now, as we're fighting for DACA, I'm really grateful that these organizations are leaned in, they've stepped up, they're present, and they're helping in the best ways possible, which is on the ground. And making our voices heard. And on top of that, allowing the space and creating the space for letting our own immigrant youth lead that fight.
Right.
And I think that's most important is creating that space to and empowering them to lead this fight themselves has been most impactful to me. And I'm just most grateful for
it. Yeah, no, that's incredible. Definitely letting people step up and lead themselves. Like if you're targeting millennials, having a millennial is going to obviously make that more impactful.
Absolutely. Yes. I just wanted to mention one of our biggest allies, United We Dream, has just done such an incredible work on mobilizing and spearheading this movement because it's personal to them. Their lives are at stake. And I just want to give them a shout. we're there with them. Yeah. I know they're going through a lot, and people have been extremely supportive. So
yeah,
I'm grateful for them.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. Well, thank you so much, Natalie, for joining us. You can follow her at Natty Montelongo, and you can follow Voto Latino at Voto Latino. It was amazing to speak with you. You're doing truly amazing work. Thank you so much for coming on.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Okay, Sarah. So I had such a great time talking with Natalie. She was so smart and so many interesting things on like voting and elections, and it's just fantastic.
Yeah, I can't wait to listen to it.
Yeah, it's going to be great. So now let's go into our gratitude checks, which are sorely needed, especially with all this very depressing voter suppression stuff.
Yeah.
So, Sarah, what are you grateful for today?
So, yeah, it's been a really, really bananas couple weeks. Like,
yeah,
even for the Trump administration, it's just like they've leveled up.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I just really needed a petty gratitude check today.
Oh, man. This one is so good.
Yeah. Shout out to Nick, who writes... like sums up all my gratitude checks. Like I literally give him an article and I'm like, I can't read and write through this. And so shout out gratitude check to Nick who helps me with that. But,
yes.
So do y'all remember the story of, I had shared this in an earlier gratitude check, the story of a man who had ghosted his girlfriend of 3 years. They were living together for two. He literally just like, she left to go on like vacation and straight up like packed up, moved out of his apartment. Like, she had no idea what the fuck happened. 10 years later, she ends up becoming his boss.
Yes. So
at his job, which is just so good. Well, there's an update to this story.
I'm so happy there's an update. I was so hoping there'd be an update.
Yeah. So he like gives this Ask a Manager blog you know, an update on the situation. And he goes on to say that Sylvia was doing just fine without him and that he didn't ruin her life, which just really feels like he's trying to, like convince himself that this wasn't actually right. that bad. He's like, well, she's fine. It's like, yeah, because she's probably yeah. fucking awesome. Like, this right. has nothing to do with you. And then he said that he took the Ask a Manager writer's advice, Allison Green, which was that the situation was likely not salvageable, but that his best option was to reach out to Sylvia so she wouldn't be blindsided, acknowledge right. his mistake, apologize sincerely, and ask her if she'd like to talk about what to do about the situation, which is the right thing to do.
It is the right thing to do.
Apparently she didn't respond because she was probably like, okay, I need to, this is a yeah. situation. So, right. Which I think was also correct. Yeah. So the next morning on a Sunday, he got a call from the chair of the board of overseers asking him to meet him as soon as possible. So he met with this chair together with Sylvia, the ex that he ghosted, on the same day. And they basically decided that they considered it was necessary to put some measures in place to avoid possible problems in the future.
Okay, that also seems fair.
Which seems totally fair.
Yeah.
He was also told in no uncertain terms that although the schedule for the year was already set, it was far more difficult to replace the director, Sylvia, than an employee, him. So they basically were like, she's more valuable to us, you dickwad. Right. Which is correct.
Which is correct.
And so these like measures included things like him and Sylvia were to never talk to each other without a third person present. All meetings had to be documented. There would be no discussion about her in the management with colleagues, not even like sort of a water cooler chat situation.
Right, right.
And this dickwad found the proposed measures, quote, rather excessive, which I would say these are rather generous.
They are rather generous.
And rather reasonable.
Yeah.
And so he decided that it would make his position unattainable, even in a short run, and therefore he resigned on the spot. He legit quit his job. Like, I love this story because women have such good long game, and this is, like, right. accidental long game. Like, she totally right. took this job not realizing that her dickwad of an ex was going to be an employee.
Right.
But she
right.
completely came out on top, and, like, he yeah. crumbled under the pressure.
Love it.
And I just love that. Like, I just yeah. really needed, like, a petty gratitude check.
It's a good one.
Okay, Devin, so what's your gratitude check for today?
Okay, so the first, I kind of have two, but they're related. Okay. So the first one is Rebecca Traister.
Yes.
She's just an amazing writer and political commentator and an intelligent human who always has the best fucking takes. So
yeah, I love her.
So she wrote an article for The Cut called Elizabeth Warren is Getting Hillary'd.
Yes.
So, and the piece itself is not what I'm grateful for because what she's talking about actually sucks. But basically the right is doing the exact same thing that we said they do, which is, you know, kind of drag Elizabeth Warren through this, you know, misogynistic meat grinder.
Yeah.
And they're making her the new boogeyman for 2020. And they're doing it the exact same way that they did it to Hillary. So,
and people on the left are falling for it again.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And so it's definitely worth a read. But
I also have sort of like larger questions, which we won't get into about like,
right.
at what point does constructive critique become fodder for the right and right. or Russian exactly. propaganda? Because it's not right. like critique is out of bounds. Like critique is totally fine. My sort of cheat code mostly is usually for men, but women have internalized misogyny too.
Right.
Is first question, would you criticize a man for the same thing?
Right.
Second question, if so, would your criticism be as forceful and frequent? That's right. just sort of my life hack for that.
Yeah, totally. Totally. And so that's definitely interesting and worth a read.
Yeah.
So there's another piece, and this is like really kind of what I'm grateful for. One of our Hellions posted in the Facebook group called Hillary Clinton and Women Who Don't Burn.
Yes.
And it is amazing. It's about how society basically burns the women they don't know what to do with. So from, you know, actual witch trials and actual burning to hysteria, like quote hysteria and mental institutions to slut shaming and Twitter harassment. In the author's words, quote, the pyres are now cable news shows, the logs op-eds, and the match is social media. Same shit, different burn.
Whoa, so, I know. That is a great line.
I know.
Same shit, different burn.
Burn, yeah. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and so then it's just about women who don't fucking burn, yes. right? And she talks about, you know, basically like how women are told, like, you know, she says, quote, "It's not easy to be burn resistant, not when society whispers in your girlish ear that you'll be admired more for your bust line than your byline."
Wow.
When from the first doll you're given to the last child you birth, you're told women must be compliant and nurturing. So, and then she talks about Hillary Clinton and her book and how Hillary just will not fucking burn. And it makes people so mad.
I love it. And I love that Hillary Clinton's like, fuck you. You don't have to buy my book or listen to me.
Right.
But I'm going to keep talking. So fuck off.
Yeah. And so the author again says, quote, "Like her or hate her, Hillary Clinton has every right in the world to tell her story. She has a right to exist, to write, to stay standing, to stay speaking. She has every right to still be there, walking away from the smoking pyre and marching into the good night on her own terms." And in case it wasn't crystal clear from the great cookie quote of 1992, Hillary Clinton is not going gently into that good night.
Yes.
So it's so good. And so, you know, reading this just really made me want to be a woman who doesn't burn, right?
Yes.
And so, Elizabeth Warren, if you're listening, I'm not making the same mistake that I made in 2016. And I feel like I burned a little then, sort of complacent in the system that was built to keep me safe and also quiet.
Right.
So, you know, if you, Elizabeth Warren, are a nominee in 2020, I will be honored to serve you. Because like I said on Monday, my greatest regret and biggest mistake is not getting more involved in Hillary's campaign, and I will not make that mistake again.
I think too, a lot of women went underground in the 2016 yeah. election because, like you said, they didn't feel safe speaking out.
Right.
And there's good reason to not feel safe. And I think a lot of women regret not, you know, being more out there and vocal. And I don't think women are going to make that mistake in 2020. Like
nope.
I don't think that a lot of men on the left understand how
right.
fucking furious and motivated women, Democratic women are. And I will just say, Rebecca Traister's book on female anger cannot come out soon enough.
Right. I know. Because this country is about to feel the full force.
Yes.
So
they're about to feel our burn. They're about to feel our
right.
burn.
We're going to burn you right back, my friends.
Yes.
So that's what I'm grateful for.
I love that. I love yeah. that. Okay, so let's get into our listener gratitude check. This is from Monique. She said, "Hellions, I know a lot of us are having rough conversations with our friends and family members right now about a whole host of issues, and it can feel overwhelming and futile sometimes." So she was saying this in the group, in our Facebook group. So she said, "But I just want to encourage everyone to stay tenacious as hell and keep having those talks. A couple of years ago, if you had told me my mother would do a 180 on so many racial issues, I would not have believed you at all. And now, these days, it is rare for me to go on Facebook and not see her talking with her conservative family, or it is rare for me to go on Facebook and not see her taking her conservative family and friends to task with incredibly detailed, well-researched comments that show she's learned and grown a lot. It just makes me super proud and happy. All the talks and the struggle through the rough, frustrating issues paid off. It can happen, y'all."
Which I love.
And I will say, too, that you know, a lot of these conversations can be frustrating and it feels like you're not making headway. But I will say that you often don't see the moment or moments that people change.
Right.
A lot of that happens
so
upon quiet reflection and you don't know
right.
when it's happening.
Right.
And I just love this because I think, you know, for white people especially, the message I heard a lot after the election from people of color was like, white people get your people. Like,
right.
we don't have the same access to those white family members of yours. And you have
right.
more clout in their eyes. Like, they will listen to you more than they will listen to us.
Right.
And I think that this story from Monique really illustrates that. So I love that.
Okay, Sarah, so it is Thursday, and so we get to do our favorite segment, Hellion of the Week.
Yes.
So who is the Hellion of the Week this week?
We're going to give it to ADAPT protesters again.
Yes.
They've been our Hellion of the Week before.
Yes.
And they fucking did it again. They put
yeah.
their bodies on the line and did the hard work that was really instrumental in killing the Graham Cassidy flaming trash heap of a fucking quote-unquote healthcare bill.
Right.
And what they did was they went to the Hill to participate in the only public hearing on Graham Cassidy, which is just bullshit for a lot of different reasons.
Right.
Once they were let in, they chanted, "No cuts to Medicaid, save our liberty." So this shit is truly life and death for them.
Yeah.
And yeah. They are just fucking heroes in my mind. Like they.
Oh, absolutely.
They really, I think, have been instrumental in helping to kill these awful healthcare bills.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, the hearing that they were chanting at was called into recess, and Capitol Police arrested these protesters, estimated to be about 100 people. They literally picked people up out of their wheelchairs and carried them out of the room.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which like, is powerful that, imagery, you know?
It is. It is. Yeah, so Susan Collins signaled that she would say be a no on this bill or this week, and that basically killed the bill.
Yeah.
And McConnell decided to not even take it to the floor for a vote. And while this is great news and definitely a win, and definitely a win by largely the ADAPT protesters, this likely won't be the end of zombie care, as it is so lovingly referred to. And it should serve as one of the main motivations to take back the House in 2018.
Yeah.
Because this is going to keep coming up unless we stop it.
Yeah. And again, I think that dovetails in nicely with our talk about elections.
Yes.
Because ultimately, like, I think, you know, the power of your vote is so powerful. I mean, that's what we have. Like, if we don't like the Congress, we got to change it. And if you have the right to vote, and some people don't because these fucking bullshit voter suppression laws, if you have the right to vote, do not take it for granted and vote for in every fucking election that you can. I think that is the biggest message, I think. We want Democrats to take, not only from 2016, but from what's happening currently.
Okay, Sarah, so last but not least, let's get into the action item. So something that our listeners can do after they're done listening to the show. First, we have an action item from our guest today, Natalie. Do you have something that you would like our listeners to do when they're done listening?
Yes. So I think that to stay engaged and to stay on top of things that are happening, they can for sure sign up for a newsletter. Go to votolatino.org and sign up for our emails. We send out actions all the time and keep people up to date. Follow us on Twitter or on Instagram. That's actually where we're most active. Latinos skew a lot higher in usage of Instagram, Twitter, and Snapchat. Less on Facebook. I think we're fairly equal, but very, very, very active on those forms. And also, in terms of DACA, right now what Congress is trying to do is get members to sign on something called a discharge petition. And that's something that would allow them to skip a couple of rules that would usually slow down the process and take the DREAM Act to a vote. The DREAM Act is bipartisan and bicameral, so it's our best chance at protecting the DREAMers. And so I would encourage everybody to call their members of Congress and encourage them to not only sign the discharge petition, but to also support the DREAM Act.
Right. Okay, so now what do we have?
Yeah, so Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands still need our support. It is important to keep them on the top of our minds, especially as, you know, our federal government continues to signal that they aren't taking this matter as urgently as they should be.
Right.
So this morning, we learned that the Trump administration has finally waived the Jones Act for Puerto Rico. So the Jones Act outlaws ships with a foreign register to ship supplies within the U.S., and it limits shipping between coasts to U.S. flagged vessels. But like in the wake of brutal storms, the government has occasionally issued temporary waivers to allow the use of cheaper, tax-free, and more readily available foreign flagged ships. For too long, Trump didn't waive it. And he basically said he wasn't waiving it because he was doing it in the interest of like businesses. And it's like,
No. No.
And especially if you waived it for these other natural disasters, like we fucking see you. So they finally waived it. But keep donating. Just keep donating because there's a lot of rebuilding that needs to be done. So Puerto Rico's first lady set up UnidosPuertoRico.com/EN. So you can go there and 100% of donations go directly to relief efforts.
Yeah. Yes. And then also call your reps and make sure that they are pushing for the U.S. government to send more aid to Puerto Rico and get organized with it. And then while you're on the phone,
yes,
we have one more action item for you. So there is a 20-week abortion ban bill up for a vote in the House. It's called Pain Capable Unborn Child Protection Act, H.R. 36. And it is a shit sandwich.
Yeah, this is not getting hardly any media attention because there's so much, you know, bullshit happening. Yeah. But it is really, really disturbing.
Oh, it's disturbing. So Rewire has an excellent legislation tracker, and it explains what the bill is and why it was introduced. So just for a little context, about 1.3% of abortions were performed after 20 weeks in 2009, according to the CDC. And I can't say this enough, but getting an abortion after 20 weeks is not something that women do for fun. Mm-hmm. I mean, even if it was, it's not the government's business. But since we have to talk about it, I cannot stress enough what this bill would do. Abortions at this stage are almost always because of medical complications for the mother or fetus. It's about safety.
Yep.
I mean, so, you know, and also side note, it's been proven over and over again that fetuses cannot feel pain at this stage. They do not develop a nervous system until later in the pregnancy. Mm-hmm. So the pain is not a factor. And at 20 weeks and beyond, it's almost never about anything except the safety of the mother.
And the child. And the fetus.
And the mm-hmm. fetus. So, mm-hmm. you know, so call your reps and raise hell over this bill.
Yeah. And I just want to say to all the dude bros who accuse me of voting with my vagina, you have ensured that I will absolutely do so from this forward. Like, BRB, gonna keep voting with my vagina. Like, that's the thing that will be happening.
Yeah. Oh, man. Well, and on that super happy note.
On that vagina-related note.
No. it's funny. So I'm going to Work It next week.
Oh, yeah.
Which is a podcast convention for women. And I was talking to my friend about it. And she was like, a lot of my male friends are like, what do you all talk about there? And she's like, how we sync up our periods to coordinate with our podcast. And
that's hilarious. I will say just... I think is an important note. Not all women have vaginas. Not all women get their periods. But yes, certainly cis women, we will be syncing up our fucking periods.
It's pretty funny. So just because guys just are truly mystified by this. But anyway, that is it for us this week. A packed show as always. We will be back on Monday.
For more information on today's episode, please visit our website at www.hellbentpodcast.com. You'll find the articles we discussed as well as additional resources.
You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at HellbentPod, and you can follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/HellbentPodcast. We also have a fan group called Dickwads Be Gone, which you can find on Facebook.
Please listen on iTunes and rate us 5 stars, because that's just like the rules of feminism. We also have a Patreon, and you can find us at patreon.com/hellbentpodcast. You can support us for as little as $1 a month, and for $5 a month, you get access to exclusive content, mini podcasts, and behind-the-scenes looks at the making of Hellbent.